morning. My name's Dan Borneo. I'm the chief cook and bottle washer for ESET 2011. And on behalf of Office of Electricity, DOE, Dr. Emery Zhuk, Brad Roberts from the ESA, and Ross Gutchinson from Sandia, I would like to welcome you to ESET 2011. This soiree is brought to you in part through DOE, who pays for our management service, and our sponsors, who include KEMA, GS Battery, Ashlon Energy, A123, FEOM, CleanTech and Connect from San Diego, and East Penn Battery, and also partnering with us is Clean Energy States Alliance, who you'll hear more from later on through the presentations. First, I'd like to introduce my team, who without their help, we wouldn't be here right now, or it would be crazier than what it is. I have Anita Andrews, who is out there on the registration. When you see her, say hi to her and thank her. Deanne Kaufman, Ann Mallow, John Beer, Kenny G, who is taping. This is the first time that I could ever recall. All the presentations will be taped, and you'll be able to get those online. Jackie Hernandez, who is all things related to the abstract book. Tom Zalzar, who I see through the doorway there, who is all things related to the sponsors and the posters. And if I missed anybody, I will announce them later. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Fire escape, if the fire alarm goes off, you will go out these doors. At the registration desk, you will make a left, go down to the end of the hallway. There's a stairwell on the left. Go down, and it'll drop you off into the parking lot on the ground level. And if you forget that, just follow the wait staff. So we have a pretty packed week here. Used to be it was a three-day ESAT and like a half a day peer review, and some people may be familiar with peer review, some might not be, but peer review is the portion of the program where all projects funded through Dr. Zhuk's program, they do a status report on their work. So that in 2009, there were 10 projects. 2011, there's about 80 projects. So as budgets have grown, so has the work. So those of you who are going to be staying just through ESAT, the ESAT is over on Wednesday afternoon. Those are going to stay with us through peer review. That will be over Thursday and Friday morning will be peer review. Tonight we will have a reception. We're looking, originally we were going to have it outside at the lawn where we were last night next to the pool, but I think we're going to bring it inside today, and the staff here is checking to see exactly where we're going to put that, and I'll let you know somewhere around lunchtime. Tomorrow we have a dinner cruise scheduled with the Hornblower. They will be picking us up down, I believe it's either gate 2 or gate 3. I'll announce that tomorrow, but basically you walk out of this hotel, go toward the bay, and right there is the pier where we'll be getting on the boat. So it's just nice and easy, and that will be from 5:30 to 9. Wednesday, Clean Tech Connect will be having a reception in the Seaview Room, which is directly below us. And also the Seaview Room is where we will be eating lunch each day, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Now, lunch on Thursday and Friday is on your own because that is sponsored by DOE, and their rules state that we can't provide lunch for those types of events. So, let's see what I got here. So the presentations, people have asked about presentations. If you want the presentations, you need to talk to the presenters and make arrangements for yourself. We will have the papers. All the presenters are supposed to be giving us their papers. We will be putting them up online on our website. We will be issuing passwords to all the participants, all the attendees. and that will be within about a month. And with that password, you'll be able to go online and download all the papers. Also, there will be a participant list on the website, and that will be, once again, in a couple weeks once we get it all finalized and get it through our system and on the web. And that website, for those of you who do not know, is www.sandia.gov/ESAT, E-E-S-A-T. They will be issuing drink tickets for tonight's event and the boat ride tomorrow. They will be issuing those at lunchtime today. If you do not get them, please see Anita Andrews or Deanne Kaufman out there at the registration desk to get those drink tickets. You don't want to go dry. Peer reviewers, anybody who was selected to be a peer reviewer, please see Anna Mollo, this young lady right here. She will be giving you all the information you need on that. If you have any problems with posters or you need help for those of you who are going to be putting up posters, see Tom Salazar. He'll take care of you there. And by the way, just a little change from the veterans of ESAT. This year we will not be having dual sessions on Tuesday. We used to do that. This year we pulled everything into a 15-minute presentation, and we also added poster sessions. And what's going to happen is in the mornings, the poster presenters, they will get 3 minutes up here at the podium to introduce their work, and then they will be able to, they will have their poster set up outside at various locations, and they'll have their poster set up for the remainder of the day, and there's approximately 6 posters per day that will be there throughout the day that you can go and visit with them and ask them questions. So I think I pretty much covered everything that I wanted to. I probably forgot some things. I'll come back. And so to keep things moving here, I want to now introduce the Dr. Zhuk. Dr. Zhuk needs no introduction. I think we all know him as the godfather of electrical energy storage for grid applications. And he is the founder of this feast. And he's been in this business a lot longer than most of us been. And he has seen it grow from a meager program into now we're the rage. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Emery Zhuk.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, welcome to the 8th ESAT conference, which, by the way, I did not found. There were one or two before I got into the business. Anthony Price can tell you all the details because he has been at every single ESAT conference. Storage is something that gives you electricity when you need it. Transmission is about space. Storage is about time. Generally, the load changes slowly or relatively slowly. Transmission was able to handle the business of bringing electricity, power, from the generation to the consumer. But things are changing. We have rapidly accelerating introduction of renewables. We are about to see plug-in electric vehicles. We are going to have distributed generation. And the challenge that is represented by these new situation to the utilities means that the time is now ripe to develop storage to assure stability in time as well as distribution over space. 12 years ago or so, the ESAT conference was a small gathering of aficionados, and the DOE Energy Storage Program had just begun. If you asked anyone in those days about energy storage, you would have found a blank stare, even among most utilities and among most people who knew the electricity business quite well. Now, of course, it is true we had pumped hydro, but somehow the greater notion of electricity storage was not really present. Nowadays, together, we have brought the technology and the applications to where we are now. Everybody knows storage now, and it's one of the hottest items in the business, storage and smart grid. And you can find it in popular in the popular literature like Time magazine and whatnot. Everybody talks about storage. So it's something to be proud of. And particularly in the last 2 years or so, the storage business has accelerated very, very considerably. And a lot of interesting events have happened. For example, storage for frequency regulation has become a reality. We have a 20-megawatt flywheel technology plant in upper New York State. We have, by Beacon Power, we have another 20-megawatt being built by AES and A123. AES has just completed a 32-megawatt station in West Virginia. So Beacon will have another 20 megawatts. Other technologies are beginning to realize that frequency regulation will represent a business opportunity, which is at least twice as effective as doing it with traditional changes in fossil fuel generations, and has a much smaller ecological footprint. What we are waiting for and what is coming is pay for performance that will also pay regulation services what they actually contribute. And FERC is well on the job, and the different ISOs. Elsewhere, Hawaii has realized that it's going to be very difficult to put in more renewables if they do not introduce storage, and they have introduced a fair amount of storage into their system. California has an interesting mandate which makes the public utility services consider storage as a serious alternative to other ways of solving the problems. Of course, one of the things that's really exciting, even though it may not be going anywhere in the present Congress, federal bills for tax rebates. If storage had a 20% tax rebate, the way renewables have, it would be a fantastic boost to the business. But the very fact that Congress has put together bills like that is a tribute to all our work. Then we have the stimulus money, which has been very welcome over and above the usual meager funding. And we have garnered $185 million for ARA projects, the stimulus projects. But what I'm really proud of is that we have $580 million in cost share. This means that people are really serious about it. They're not just taking a handout. Storage is being developed. And I'm very pleased that we just commissioned the first of our ARA projects, a joint photovoltaic and lead carbon battery by East Penn. That was only 3 weeks ago, and I think it's a hallmark event in the history of storage. I might also mention that the companies that take part in the ARA funding, or our program in general, are being noticed. In the 200, among the 200 awards for the Going Green, the Going Green awards, 9 of them are from our group. That's a very sizable proportion and something to be proud of. And then getting into the practical aspects, we are beginning to see rate cases. Chief among those, San Diego Gas and Electric has put in a $50 million rate case, and that segues over into our keynote speaker, William Torrey, who is chief engineer of San Diego Gas and Electric, and he's particularly in charge of development of new technologies. And Bill Torrey has a master's degree of engineering from California Polytechnic, and he's a senior member of IEEE, Register Engineer in California. He established a power engineering program at San Diego State University, an important thing because for a long time power engineering has been very much in decline in the U.S. Educational system. But we are beginning to see a strong and rising interest. And Bill Torrey has taught there for 7 years. Now, as being in charge of new developments, among other accomplishments, he did a, what was it, $1.8 billion 500 kV line, which was built out for San Diego Gas and Electric. And, well, now we'll have Bill Torrey tell you himself about what San Diego Gas and Electric does, and particularly what it does about energy storage. Bill, there you are.
Well, I'm glad to be here today. It's my pleasure to be here and an honor to be here in front of a group of experts in energy storage. First want to say welcome to San Diego on behalf of San Diego Gas and Electric Company, the local utility here. We have been working on energy storage for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, and I've been involved in energy storage over the last 30 years of my career on and off. And today I just wanted to talk, I was asked to talk here, give you kind of an introductory talk, a little bit about some of the problems that I think the energy storage field is facing going forward. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about what we're doing here at San Diego Gas and Electric Company. First, one of the things that we're facing, the title of the slide here shows what I'm talking about. I really believe that energy storage is a key building block to smart grid as we move forward. SDG&E has a fairly aggressive smart grid plan. It's been filed with the CPUC, both in our general rate case filing and also in our deployment plan filing as part of the OIR hearings that are ongoing. One of the issues that we're facing is increasing renewable generation. And renewable generation in general is very variable. It fluctuates up and down. Most of it's PV solar, some of it's wind generation. And there's two issues that the variable resources really present. One is the issue of resource adequacy, and the other is the power quality issues associated with it. And the resource adequacy issues include things like ramping of generation, spinning reserve, dispatch, firming up the dispatch, things like that. The power quality issues are more prevalent on the distribution system where we have more distributed generation connected to our system. And there we're seeing problems with related to the intermittency, mainly with rooftop PV and the clouds coming and going and the power coming on and off. And I'll show you some graphs on that a little bit later. And then also the issues with voltage regulation. And then the second issue that I think that we're really facing as an industry in energy storage is distribution capacity upgrade deferrals. One of the distributed generation can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. If it's done incorrectly and just connected to the system without any thought to it, it could actually cause us to have to upgrade the systems even more. But if it's done the right way, it could actually be a positive thing and help reduce upgrades on the distribution system. And the other thing is related to improving efficiency of operation is the peak shifting. If we can use energy storage to shift off-peak hour production, say, from wind generation to on-peak, then that'll improve the overall efficiency of operation. And the third thing that if we can capture is the benefits of reduced greenhouse gas. What are some of the problems that we're facing in terms of deployment of energy storage? Well, one of the key things is ownership. Ownership and operation. Who should own the energy storage? Should it be utilities or should it be customers? Perhaps a generation supply side should own energy storage, or even possibly private parties that could actually install energy storage and then sell a service. Or maybe it's a combination of all of these things. And then another issue with regard to deployment is the regulatory issues. Who pays for the regulatory issues? Utility customers will they pay through charges in the ISO tariff? Or perhaps a utility would establish a distribution charge and charge utilities customers that way. These are all unanswered questions. Renewable generators, perhaps they will be required to install energy storage to firm up their renewable resources. Right now we have an ongoing order of investigation by the CPUC, stimulated by AB 2514. I think Emery mentioned that in his opening talk there, that in California we've got an ongoing investigation by the CPUC in energy storage, and they're addressing some of these very issues. And then where's the best place from a regulatory perspective for the energy storage to be, at the generator or at the load side? These are questions that need to be answered. And then lastly, what is the proper size of energy storage and where is the proper location? Would it be on the distribution system or should it be distributed with small distribution size energy storage units, or should it be at the substation or possibly even at the generating stations? And then another question that we're facing with regard to deployment is how do we control energy storage? Do we use an aggregation of control? Or do we have more distributed control? There's advantages and disadvantages to both of those, and we're testing both of those concepts. And then I thought that I would just touch on this, the business case for energy storage. When you start looking at energy storage, how do you pencil out a business case? And one of the first things you have to address is the technology selection. There seems to be a wide variety of technology selection. You can step out in the lobby here and see a lot of different technologies being displayed. For those of you who have been involved in energy storage for a lot of years, you've seen a lot of different technologies come and go. And I think that the way, from a utility perspective, is to look at the application. What is the specific application you're looking at? Are you trying to solve a power quality problem on a distribution circuit, or are you trying to resolve say, the variability of a large wind generation site and trying to provide a more firm resource. And so it depends on the application, the size and the type of energy storage. If you're trying to capture, say, off-peak shifting, then you're going to need a lot of energy storage, kilowatt hours. But if you're just trying to solve power quality problems, then maybe less kilowatt hours but more kilowatts, more capacity. And so you have your selection of different energy storage devices, chemical batteries, compressed air energy storage, pumped hydro, thermal, and other types of energy storage. And then you have to look at, like I mentioned, the amount, how much energy storage, kilowatt hours or kilowatts do you need? And then when you're looking at the business case, is capturing the benefits. I think the Sandia Lab study did a really good job on identifying a lot of the benefits for energy storage. They had a list of maybe 15, 20 benefits there. And when you start looking at the business case, the more benefits that you can capture for the system, the better it looks in terms of business case. The ancillary services, for example, frequency regulation. The Cal ISO here in California has a regulation energy market, spinning reserve, volt VAR dispatch, ramping. These are a few of the ancillary services. And I think as we move forward, there's going to be more ancillary services offered. I did mention peak shifting earlier, deferment of utility upgrades, and firming of renewables. Other benefits, as Emery mentioned, there's some work in Congress about a new tax credit for energy storage. Here in California, we have the Small Generator Interconnection Program, which just recently included and added energy storage to that, and there is a credit that you can get there. And then there's also the potential in the future of carbon credits. You've probably all seen these graphs. They're from the ESA, but they basically show a comparison of costs, cost per kilowatt hour and cost per O&M on the upper. If I can do this here. Whoop, that wasn't the right one. Let's go back. Oh, here we go. These are different technologies here. And then over here, I thought these graphs kind of show a pretty good comparison of kilowatt-hour cost per kilowatt and then the different energy storage technologies. Well, let me say a few more things about San Diego Gas and Electric Company and what we're doing here. Well, first of all, SDG&E, we're located in San Diego, the southwest here. And we're a modest-sized company of about 1.4 million electric meters, all of which have been converted to smart meters at this point. We have 4,500 employees, give or take a few. We service areas about 4,000 square miles. We cover two counties, Orange County and San Diego County. And we have a pretty robust transmission system running up from 69 to 500 kV, and quite a few substations and tie lines. Our distribution system is predominantly 12 kV distribution. We have over 10,000 miles, most of which is underground, about 60% underground, and quite a few, about almost 300 substations on our system. Lastly, I would want to mention, too, here is that we do have quite a few plug-in electric vehicles in our service territory. We have an ongoing program with the DOE through what we call the EcoTality Project to promote electric vehicles here. We're coupled with Nissan Leaf, or nice Nissan. We're installing over 1,000 Nissan Leafs in the service territory, plus a large deployment of public charging stations. And, in fact, one aspect of energy storage that I might mention just off the side is that it looks to me that energy storage may have a play in the electric vehicle area from the area of two areas, really. One is the area of DC fast charging and reducing the demand charge. And the other is using electric vehicles as a storage device, basically vehicle to grid, or vice versa. What's driving us for energy storage at SDG&E? Well, one thing is the changing resource mix. The pink here is photovoltaics, and you can see here in 2010, very, very little photovoltaics, but as we move forward in time to 2020, we're increasing photovoltaics quite a bit. And the other is wind generation. You can see the light blue here is the wind generation increasing over time. And in fact, by 2020, we expect that to be roughly the combination of wind and solar to be about 30% of our resource mix. A lot of these resources will be on the transmission system, but quite a few are also going to be installed on the distribution system. And one thing I think that's been overlooked a little bit is the impact on the distribution system. When you start looking at the penetration of photovoltaics on our system, you're seeing an increasing impact on the distribution system. And this graph here, the red bars are indicated of circuits that have over 30% penetration. And the blue bars here show the increasing impact on distribution circuits with over 20% penetration. And as you can see, we start out here, say, in 2011, and maybe we've got 20 circuits that are over 30% penetration. But by the time we get out to 2016, we're almost at 60%, or 60 circuits, so almost three times as many circuits with 30% penetration of photovoltaics. So it's increasing at a fairly rapid rate. We've been doing some studies with Electric Power Research Institute studying this. We have ongoing studies both with monitoring of the circuits and computer simulations to better understand exactly the problems that we're facing. And I'll show some graphs of some of the voltage regulation issues that we're looking at. This map here shows some of the locational-wise where we're having penetration of photovoltaics and electric vehicles actually on the same map. The purple dots here, the purple dots are the photovoltaics in our system, and the green dots are actually electric vehicle owners throughout our service territory. So you can see we're scattered, a lot of it's along the coastal area in here. And San Diego, we have a kind of an interesting weather phenomenon down the California coast. It's called the marine layer that moves in and out. And that causes a great deal of intermittency. So a lot of the people live along the coast because it's nice and cool, like it is today here. But on the other hand, for photovoltaics, it has its advantages and disadvantages. One of the problems is the issue of intermittency and providing good power quality to our customers. This graph here shows our forecast for rooftop photovoltaic on the residential side, or what we call net energy metering. And the red line here is actually from the California Energy Commission forecast, and the blue here is where we're actually what we've actually recorded in terms of installation. You can see the blue is slightly above the red forecast. We're a little over 100 megawatts of rooftop solar. Per capita-wise, we're one of the highest growing photovoltaic regions in the country. And the graphs over here kind of show it in a bar graph, but you can see it's been steadily increasing over the last few years at a fairly rapid rate. Imagine some of you have seen graphs like this before. This is a graph of the power output of two different photovoltaic facilities. It kind of illustrates some of the intermittency issues with the clouds going over photovoltaics. This is a 10-megawatt facility here up in the green graph up here. This next graph right here is a graph of the voltage on the primary side of the distribution system, near a 2-megawatt PV facility on one of our distribution circuits here in San Diego. And it shows it over a 24-hour period or a portion of it. And then we took a slice out of here, just kind of randomly took a slice out of here and looked at it over a 10-minute period. And you can see that because PV doesn't really have voltage regulation capability, it's basically one per unit power factor, it drives the voltage up fairly high when it's at steady state. And then you see these voltage fluctuations as clouds go over. And these are out of our CVR beyond the required limits for voltage regulation. In California, we have conservation voltage regulation, and we're encouraged to stay within those limits. This graph, some of you may have seen, it shows some of the variability. I still think it's a good graph. It's from the California ISO, but it shows some of the wind generation here. Each line in here represents a different day of the month of December. It's back in 2009. But you can see, like on one day, it was wind generation was up around 800 megawatts, and within a few hours it dropped down to almost zero. You can see the other days that there's quite a bit of variability in the wind, and that's becoming an increasing concern, especially as we start moving forward with higher levels and penetration of renewable resources. So that's where energy storage comes into play. We are testing energy storage at San Diego Gas and Electric Company. We're currently testing this energy storage that was integrated by Greensmith in conjunction with Electric Power Research Institute. This unit is 82 kilowatt hours, 50 kilowatt capacity, and it's using these international batteries. It's a lithium-ion phosphate batteries. And then we're also looking at these distributed energy storage units and some substation-scale energy storage systems. This is kind of a summary of the Greensmith testing. As I mentioned, the power capacity is 50 kilowatts, energy capacity 82 kilowatt hours. It was using a power converter that was built by StatCon, which is usually PV, but it's been converted to four-quadrant operation capability. It does have some grid-supported functionality, and we're in the process of testing that system. Okay. I took one slide out here because we haven't awarded the contract yet, so I didn't want to talk about it. But we have basically these two projects, a microgrid project, which is DOE-funded project. It's about it's also California Energy Commission funded. It's about $7 million from DOE, about $3 million from CEC, and about $5 million from SDG&E and our partners. We have substation-level energy storage included, 500 kilowatts, 1,500 kilowatt-hour battery system at the substation. It's at a location called Borrego. Borrego is located in the desert on the eastern end of our system. It just has one transmission line feeding it, kind of a remote area, and this is an ideal location for a microgrid because of its isolation and the need for improved reliability. We are also deploying energy storage as part of our smart grid. Right now, we have smart grid and what we call initial projects, capital projects, and it's being funded through SDG&E Capital. And right now, we're installing a 500 kilowatt, 1500 kilowatt hour battery, similar to the one we have in the microgrid project. This will be a different manufacturer than this one. We're also installing three distributed energy storage systems here, as well as in the microgrid project, both of which will be the 25 kilowatts in capacity, 50 kilowatt hour. Those units will be connected to the secondary side of our transformers and the low voltage. So those will be single phase units. I did put this graph in here. Okay. Here is the distributed energy storage systems, and here's the lithium-ion battery that goes inside. Just a little bit about our microgrid project. It includes commercial or substation size energy storage here at our Borrego substation. It also includes community size or distributed energy storage out on the distribution circuit. We'll have three of those dispersed along a distribution circuit. And then it'll also include some home energy storage within the customer's homes. So it has three different aspects in energy storage. And the concept behind the microgrid is to be able to balance load and generation on a localized basis. The project will also include distributed generation control. It'll have an overarching microgrid controller that'll control the whole system on a micro scale, independent of the overall control operation system at SDG&E. But it'll have communication with it, but it'll also be able to island the system and operate it as an independent island. Some of the benefits here, to be able to demonstrate integration of renewables and leverage the generation and storage configurations to demonstrate smart grid technologies, reduce the peak load of the feeders, enhance system reliability, and enable our customers to become more interactive in managing their energy use. One of the aspects of this project will include what we call price-driven load management, and the customers will actually have home area networks in their homes and real-time simulated pricing and be able to actually manage their distributed generation as well as load. And in closing, I just want to say that, you know, San Diego Gas and Electric has a very comprehensive smart grid plan. As Emery mentioned, we have almost over $100 million in budgeted for energy storage over the next 5 years at SDG&E. And that's going through a general rate case hearings at the present time. SDG&E has tested energy storage. We believe that it's needed both in distribution system and on the transmission system to help integrate renewables. We think there are some issues, some technical issues, some regulatory issues, but I believe that we'll be able to overcome those issues, and I believe that energy storage will be a very important building block to developing a green future for San Diego, and I really applaud your effort here at this conference to help promote that effort in energy storage. Thank you. Oh, one thing I did want to say is right at the end there, I do actually own an energy storage device. My last slide right here, right there is my portable energy storage device. It's called an electric car. And so maybe someday that'll be able to contribute to the grid also. Thanks. Anybody questions or anything? Or yes, sir. All right. What qualifies as a circuit in our system, and how many circuits do we have in our system? First of all, when I say distribution circuit, I'm talking about our 12 kV distribution. And let me look at the statistics here, but we have over 1,000 distribution circuits on our system. So that's pretty much my answer to that question. And other questions? Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, Bob Blackstock with SunEdison. I saw on the slide that you had the projection of the solar with many other energy sources with that, and the solar growing nicely. But also on the top of that bar graph was peaker plants, and the peaker plant growth growing pretty much in step with the solar path growth. So could you explain why the peaker plant is going up also?
Well, I think that as I think I wasn't real, not on the resource side of things. I'm more on the ET&D side, transmission distribution. But I could venture to answer that question. I think, first of all, for the benefit of everybody else, the question was in the slide with renewables. I could maybe pop back there real quick. Right there. The question was why is the peaker plant increasing here? And I think the thought is, and this is where energy storage could play a key role, and maybe this is why you've asked your question, is as we start incorporating more and more renewables here and we start reducing our base load, you know, we have to have the solar, the sun doesn't necessarily shine at the same time our system peaks, for example. Our system peaks around, the PV production peaks around noon, right? Sun straight up, where our load is peaking around, say, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so some of the thought here probably is that we're using peaking generation to pick up that peak load that the renewables can't pick up. It's a more overall efficient dispatch because you're using renewable resources here, but you still need some peak generation to catch the peak. Now, I think that it's very possible that if we can make a positive case for energy storage, that we may be able to reduce this peaking capacity requirement. Does that help answer your question? Okay. Any other questions?
Yes.
Back there?
Bill, this is Pramod Kulkarni with the California Energy Commission.
Oh.
You had shown a slide shows that by 2016, almost 200 of your feeders would have more than 20 or 30% photovoltaics.
Yeah, right there.
To make a business case, what are the options for managing this? Absent energy storage, how would you manage the issues created by these on these feeders? And could that make a business case? I know each feeder has its own unique characteristic and how to mitigate that, but what's the general strategy for mitigating these voltage fluctuations?
Yeah, I think there's several possible solutions. I think energy storage may be one of them. We're also investigating and testing dynamic voltage support to help supplement the voltage regulation problems. And I think also that if we can do some things on the generation side, on the inverters for photovoltaics, for example, and we're working on this in 1547.8, some of the smart inverter functionality, where the inverters can actually help provide voltage regulation, help provide frequency regulation, have frequency droop response capability, have fault ride-through, low voltage sag ride-through, that kind of thing that PV inverters don't have today but could have in the future. And so I think there are several different solutions that may be able to help allow us to continue to install more renewables on our distribution system, and we're working on that and testing it right now. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you a detailed question. You talked about a lithium ion system. Who made it? International Battery Lithium.
Right.
Who is that?
It's a company. Yeah. They make batteries. Yeah.
Quick question about is compressed air energy storage an option for you to meet your peak load at some point?
Well, asked about compressed energy storage, compressed air energy storage. In California, I think PG&E has a project with DOE. I believe it's funded for compressed air energy storage to test using a natural gas field, a depleted natural gas field for compressed air energy storage. we're kind of waiting to see how that goes. In California, we really don't have the natural geologic formations that's like, say, Alabama or some of the other states have with salt domes, things like that. We have looked at above ground compressed air energy storage, man-made containers that can contain compressed air energy storage, perhaps for helping supplement our peaking requirements. When we start looking at the business case, it looks difficult just because of the cost. But perhaps as we go along with the project, the DOE project up in the Central Valley area, the 300-megawatt case project there, we'll get more information and understand, what the possibility of using depleted natural gas formations is. Okay. Well, one more question. Okay, go ahead.
Sure. Samir Sukar, NRDC. I was just curious, to the extent that you're facing challenges on both the distribution and transmission system, to what extent do you see the need for increased coordination or even integration between the planning functions on those two parts of the system?
The planning functions?
Right, so system planning for the distribution system and transmission system, to what extent do you see the need for integrating or coordinating those, and to what extent will that help to illuminate the need for optimal deployment of energy storage?
That's a good question, very good question. I think it's often overlooked, and it really needs more emphasis. That's a good point. As we move forward with higher penetration of renewable generation on our system, both at the distribution side and on the transmission side, and we're relying more on the variability of those generating resources, what we're seeing on the distribution system is actually in some cases reverse power flow. We're seeing some pretty radical changes in the topology of our networks and how they're operated. And I just make a long story short, I believe that the transmission and distribution planning functions need to work close together cooperatively, and not only on the planning functions, but even on the operating side as well. And just real briefly, why is because as we have these higher penetrations of renewable resources, both on transmission and distribution, we're seeing changes in how they actually operate, voltage regulation. We've always designed our system for voltage regulation on our distribution side so that we have a voltage regulated at the substation circuit that we had never planned for. And then you start pushing power backwards on the circuit. Our system wasn't designed that way. And on the transmission side, we've always planned the transmission. I was in transmission planning for 13 years. Transmission planning, we always design the system so that we're bringing power from central generating plants and delivering it down through the transmission to the distribution substations. Well, now we're potentially seeing VARs coming back up off the distribution system. And traditionally, VARs and reactive power have always flowed down to the distribution system. And at light load, we could even see power flowing back the other way. So our thinking of how we plan the system has to be a little bit different. And this is where I think smart grid technology comes in, that we can do some things using smart technology to accommodate these higher level of renewables. But it just requires a little different thinking on the planning side, both for distribution and transmission, both sides need to work together, really, to optimize overall system design. And the same thing on operations. There's got to be more communication. Traditionally, there's been kind of a line kind of drawn between distribution and transmission. I think we're going to see more and more integrated operations going forward. And then on the regulatory side, at least in California, our distribution system is regulated by CPUC on the rate making and everything, whereas on the transmission, it's regulated by FERC. And so you got two different entities establishing the laws and rules and how they're operated and how upgrades are made, capital investments. And there needs to be more interaction and cooperation there as well. So very, very good question. So if there are any other further questions, At this time, I think I will excuse myself and let the next speaker. Are we on plan?
Yeah, we've got time for three or four questions.
Yeah, okay.
Matt Lazarevich from Beacon Power. I have a
Matt.
Question. When the early, some of the earlier slides showed who's going to be paying for some of these storage devices. What about, has there been any thought given to the fact that sometimes when a storage device comes into play, the generators actually can end up operating a little differently with higher efficiency? Mm-hmm. And so they can get some passive benefits from the fact that the storage device on here. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to take some of those benefits and kind of direct them back to the storage device that actually allowed those those benefits to actually occur? It's a change in some of the tariff structures, but it certainly is a way how to help the overall system cost goes down as well as help get the new technologies funded.
Good question. I'm not a regulator, so. But you know, I think there is. I think there's got to be, and there should be, because I think the energy storage providers should be compensated for the benefit that they're adding to the system. You know, I think that energy storage can help the generation operate more efficiently, and there are, you know, if there is a benefit, then it should be shared. Like I say, I'm not a regulator, so I don't set the rules. But as we go through these hearings, like we're going through right now with the OIR, there's opportunity for everyone to, you know, provide input into that.
The point was just not to, you know, not to have to point at somebody who has to pay for this benefit as a new tariff or as a new cost, but just shift the benefits back. So that other people don't have to pay for the storage.
Right, right, exactly. That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
Hey, Bill. We've got one more for you.
Okay.
Mike Manoring with HDR Engineering. You mentioned
Mike.
The difference between FERC and the ISOs having regulatory authority over both generation and transmission, and kind of neither the two shall meet. Have you thought about or talked with any folks at OWN, say, gas storage? I mean, there's an energy storage asset class through gas storage. Mm-hmm. Through electricity, if there was an energy storage asset class that combines both transmission and generation, is this something that you guys have thought about? Would you see value in that? This is something that I know the hydropower folks are talking to FERC about right now in their response to that NOI recently, trying to get out of the dueling authorities from both FERC and the ISOs.
Hmm. And it's an interesting concept. I'm not that familiar with it. I know that we have a fair amount of gas storage for natural gas. Our company and our sister company, SoCal Gas, has a sizable amount of gas storage capability. I don't know how much research has been done in that area of trade-off of say hydro and natural gas storage. I think that's what you're talking about. And that aspect of it, I'm not all that familiar with, but something definitely worth taking a look at.
Is this working? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, Bob Blackstock again with SunEdison. Any thoughts about allowing storage to participate in demand response programs?
We have had some discussion about that. At least internally, we've had some discussion that energy storage device can look a lot like demand response. It's, in fact, in some ways more favorable because you're not actually curtailing a customer's load. What you're doing is using the energy storage as a generating device to offset load, and it does have that potential. One of the projects on our microgrid project, the Borrego Springs microgrid project, has price-driven load management that feeds back to a thing called a microgrid controller. And that microgrid controller can actually control the distributed energy resources such as photovoltaics and some diesel generators that we have. But it can also control loads as well. And as I mentioned earlier, we have in that project home energy storage. So it can send a dispatch signal to the energy storage to dispatch. And so we'll get some, I think, results from that that will give us a better idea of how effective energy storage can be used for demand response. Then now that I think about it, we've got a couple other projects that we're working on with the city here in San Diego in that area as well.
Petersen, Dong Energy, Denmark. In your slides, you mentioned as well thermal storage. You had not shown any examples of that. And further, I will follow up on the question of the storage of power as gas. We in Denmark have 20% of our power from wind, so we do have some research in the area of storing electricity as gas. As further, we want to store biogas as natural gas. We want to store gasification gas from wood as methane. So we do a lot of things in that area especially.
Okay.
But it was the question about the thermal storage.
Thermal storage, right. Gotcha. Well, first I'd like to say that in some ways, Dong Energy is close to my heart. I was just there at Dong Energy just a couple weeks ago. I spent 3 weeks there in Denmark in your planning department, and it was as part of our Smart Grid Exchange program. And I was very thankful to be involved with that, and I really enjoyed working with the engineers there at Dong Energy. I know that there in Denmark they have a lot of combined heat and power, CHP. And a lot of it's been developed in Denmark. They have a lot of central heating that uses water for heating. And that can actually be used as a kind of a storage system. And here in California, I think, too, you know, we've been looking at combined heat and power as a resource. I probably haven't mentioned it here too much. It hasn't, in our service territory, hasn't been something that's proliferated, combined heat and power. But I think that it could. I think there's, when you start looking at efficiencies, the combined heat and power with thermal storage has some definite advantages. So I think it'll definitely be part of the portfolio of energy storage devices and going forward in the future. Thanks. All right.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. Thank you.
From the University of Arkansas, and Ann Margolis from the Clean Energy States Alliance, Jeff Hires from GS Battery, Jackie Hernandez from Sandia National Labs, and Ms. Lim from the University of Colorado at Boulder. And what we'll do is have a three-minute introduction to their poster session, and their posters are set up outside, and we hope that you go out there and look at them and talk to these individuals about their work.
Good morning, everyone. And hopefully my slide presentation will be coming up in a moment. Yes, there we go. I'm Roy McCann with the University of Arkansas, and I'm collaborating with a small startup company, LGW, that specializes in advanced battery technology. The project that we have, it's a pilot study on the use of battery-based energy storage for demand response management applications along the lines of one of the questions from the previous session. Okay, demand response for this pilot project focused on rural electric cooperative environments. For rural electric co-ops, for many years they've already have deployed demand response systems due to the challenges that are intrinsic in that market sector. The problems are that rural systems are often susceptible to storm damage, and because of the nature of farm and agricultural areas, it's important to have a backup power. So there's already in place often to have power line modulated carrier signals that interface to the electric utility provider to cut back on pump loads or air conditioning loads, And in many cases, there is an installed backup generator that's often natural gas or propane-based. Now, the disadvantage is clearly is that for the electric utility perspective, although it provides some demand response capability, it has a disadvantage of still kind of a low power quality of service, and likewise is a lost revenue opportunity. Okay, so the idea with a distributed energy management system, it provides or mediates many of those concerns that we have with the existing demand response systems. The idea with a battery-based system is that, particularly in the pilot study area where we were located in Arkansas and Oklahoma, there is a growing base of wind and solar power. And in the case for wind energy, often the wind is strongest in that area in the few hours before sunrise, which coincides naturally with a low demand period. And so we can then utilize that with battery storage to harvest that and then discharge during the following peak period in the afternoon. Similarly, for the areas of the country with an afternoon peak period, then solar can be used to augment the battery discharge to implement a demand response routine. And in either case, for the case of rural electrics, where they often have contracts which restricts their purchasing strictly from a dedicated wholesaler, then there's a tendency towards wide price fluctuations with this type of a scheme. Then there's load leveling and allows for battery storage to be charged during the off-peak time and allow for load leveling with a subsequent afternoon peak demand. Okay, the system that we've introduced is a lead-acid battery. It's an advanced technology that incorporates a nanocrystalline paste into the battery cells, and from our laboratory measurements, achieves 16-18% greater reserve capacity. The interface then goes through an inverter circuit that is enabled to communicate with the electric utility and responds to discharge commands or incentives to begin charging during the off-peak periods. The current investigation is also looking at providing for voltage and frequency regulation in addition to the demand response functionality. Okay, an example of one of the pilot sites at a rural installation. This is just showing the peak period begins at 2 p.m., and then we initiate a battery discharge. For this particular system, it's a 75-kilowatt-hour battery with a 12-kilowatt peak inverter. And then after the peak time window shuts down, it's approximately 6 p.m., then it can revert to another program mode depending upon the circumstances. Another pilot location is at a commercial facility which has a 65-kilowatt wind turbine. And in this particular facility, they make printed circuit board assemblies, and they have ovens that power up in the early morning hours when the wind power is available. And then, however, in general, the wind may not coincide with the peaks that occur with the ovens turning on, in which case then the challenges for commercial facilities is that often their annual billing rate is determined by the measured 15-minute window peak that occurs during a specified window. So if they incur a large peak momentarily due to an oven being turned on, then they pay a penalty for that throughout the year. And then we are continuing to work with Ozarks Electric and Caddo Electric Cooperatives, our partners in the pilot study, to evaluate then the wide-scale deployment and what the financial implications would be. And we're seeing in the case in Oklahoma or areas of Oklahoma where the payoff period may be on the order of 1.5 years. So that's all that I have for now. It's the brief introduction. I'd be happy to talk to anyone during the poster session. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Ann Margolis, and I'm with Clean Energy States Alliance. I am here to shake up your morning with the probably least technical poster you're going to see here. Clean Energy States Alliance is a coalition of state clean energy funds. Our acronym is CESA, not to be confused with California Energy Storage Alliance, the West Coast CESA. We have started, with the help of DOE and Sandia, what we're calling the Energy Storage Technology Advancement Partnership, or ESTAP. The purpose of ESTAP is to create partnerships along the lines of the partnerships that California, for example, or New York through NYSERDA currently have with DOE. There are a lot of states that are very interested in storage, but really maybe don't know how to get started, or it's not a priority of theirs. So we're trying to bring a whole bunch of states sort of along the path towards being on the level of a CEC or NYSERDA partnership with DOE. We have started some surveys. Many of you may have received the stakeholder survey, but we've also done a state survey. 75% of the states that have responded, and that's about 16 states to date, it's only been out for about a month now, indicate they're very interested in collaborating with DOE on energy storage projects, especially commercial and demonstration projects, and especially projects surrounding renewables. Why work with states? States have resources. You can see here from 1998 through 2009. This is just CESA member states alone incentivized 70,000 projects with 3 gigawatts of installed capacity with $2.7 billion, and that leveraged about $9.7 billion of outside investment. And states are going to be investing about $7.2 billion by 2017 in clean energy projects. So there's a lot of resources there, and also states can be great partners in other ways. States want to work together with other stakeholders on renewables as well as other clean energy projects, including energy storage. States are involved in permitting. They're involved in project siting, so it's great to have a state as your committed partner. States also have jurisdiction over utilities in many cases. We heard about CPUC and resource planning. In my meetings with states so far, we've noticed a ton of interest from states in partnering with other entities, including manufacturers, on some really creative project ideas. So the status is that we're creating these relationships with states. Hopefully that will work towards a memorandum of understanding between the state and DOE that specifies that the states will work together with DOE and Sandia on technical assistance, and then work towards a co-funding RFP that'll either be put out by Department of Energy, depending on the funding in FY12, or it could be put out in a distributed way amongst a number of states. And then we're looking here at distributed energy storage technologies. So these are not necessarily very large projects due to the funding that might be available. But I would encourage you to get involved in a number of ways. You can visit my poster. And then on the table out here, there's a handout that shows the stakeholder survey and has my contact information, shows the link for the stakeholder survey. So I'd encourage you to please come talk to me if you know about some your state, if there's a partnership opportunity there, if you know someone who's really excited in your state energy office, for example, about energy storage, and maybe I haven't met with them yet, happy to set up a meeting and get some of these partnerships going. And I'd like to thank Dr. Jacques, as well as all of the great people at Sandia, including Abbas Keel and Dan Borneo, Georgianne Huff, and Ross Guttrumson. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Hires with GS Battery USA Incorporated. We're a subsidiary of GS Yuasa Corporation of Japan. This presentation will highlight two renewable energy storage projects that GSB has been a part of over the last 18 months. We'll briefly touch on the specs of each project, some of the collected data that we have to date, and the projected economics of each system. The first project was installed at a commercial office building at Mesa del Sol in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It features roughly 17 kilowatts of a PV, 15 kilowatts of power conditioning systems, the inverter and charge controllers, and approximately 20.5 kilowatt hours of battery storage. Two of the storage benefits we want to demonstrate at this site include the time of use energy cost management, as well as renewable energy time shift. This slide shows some of the collected data and features that are capabilities of the system, where we can charge the batteries from PV and shift that energy to the time that's needed. The way the system is set up, we currently they are currently on a rate of 14 cents per kilowatt hour for all renewable energy produced. And since the meter for that production is tied on the load side of the building meter. They also can take advantage of the time of use energy cost management by shifting some of that stored renewable energy from the batteries to extend to the time of use rate, which their current rate is 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. On peak. The next system was installed at our headquarters in Roswell, Georgia. It includes roughly 37.5 kilowatts of PV and 30 kilowatts of PV inverter and 15 kilowatts of battery inverter charge controller. Two of the benefits demonstrated here primarily is UPS function for our clean room fans, lighting, receptacle loads, and another function is time of use energy cost management, similar to the previous system. This shows a typical week of charging discharge curves of the system. Our current time of use energy rate in Georgia is from 2 to 7 p.m., so we kind of mimic that when discharging the batteries to the grid. The system is set up where we're selling all of our PV generated directly to the grid under a service tariff at 17 cents a kilowatt hour. It was more economical in the payback to do that instead of using that to charge the batteries. The battery system itself is charged and discharged to the grid only, no PV assistance. And you can see that some of the calcs are the projected calcs that we'll be confirming in the next year. And finally, the last slide shows kind of three, the main reasons or I guess, factors that everyone should think about, I guess, when trying to play the payback game with time of use, namely the whether you're assisting charging the batteries from PV, that plays a part. The main factor is kind of which rates you're on. A couple examples shown. One is in Georgia, 122 days per year is the on-peak, and then to the right is in Japan, they have a rate that goes 365 days a year, which you can see that cuts the payback down immensely. Thank you for your time.
Hello, my name is Jacqueline Hernandez. My technical poster presentation is on the United States Renewable Energy Portfolio Standards and how these mandates bring with them policy and legal issues. In this brief discussion, I will share, according to the outline, three specific goals. I want to state the problem, define some specific issues, and share some observations and potential recommendations. The problem is there is no U.S. federal policy for renewable portfolio standards. You'll see a map that has the 29 states and Washington, D.C. with mandates to have renewable resources as part of the generation mix. However, the regulations either do not exist or they vary from state to state. Other things that vary, the type of renewable source, the percentages, the enforcement mechanisms, the timeline implementation guidelines. So what concerns you in this audience is an issue that's also on the slide, is that the renewable standards were written that involve variable energy resources that affect grid reliability. However, energy storage was not explicitly written into those policies. There is, however, one place that's making up for that gap. We're here, California, Assembly Bill 2514 that Dr. Zhuk alluded to. This is data that I extracted from the IER data that tracks electricity mandates. So far, or effective December 2010, there are 12 states on track to satisfy the RPS mandates. This is an image that I constructed with Mona Aragon of Sandia National Laboratories to illustrate that policy and legal issues related to energy storage are complex. You've got generation support. Are you going to use ancillary services? Is a driver asset deferral? As energy storage applications and their associated technologies evolve, the questions related to the energy storage policy and legal issues also evolve. This is evident in the FERC 2011 June Notice of Inquiry. So in closing, I'd like to encourage you in this industry and in this audience to help address, are we going to look at energy storage as a regulated functionality or market functionality? My bias, of course, is to push toward market design, market structure innovations. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Lim. I'm a graduate student at the University of Colorado at Boulder. I'm going to skip real quick a few of the slides because it's been mentioned before. It's been increased in renewable energy in the grid. And in the state of Colorado, where I am, we are required to have about 30% of renewable energy by the year 2020. So I start out with a very simple model. I've got a battery, and I've got a PV panel, and I've got a load. So what I've showed is that the internal characteristics of the battery will actually smooth the the variations of the load from the PV. So these are the results that I have. And so this is a model that I have. I've got several types of generation hooked up to a customer load. And the battery storage is there to reduce the frequency variations due to the wind power source. And I've got several assumptions that I have. The wind turbines are fixed speed. I've got four sources of power. My load is a constant output for now. I just want to show that with increasing penetration of renewable, you can have excessive frequency variations on the grid. This is the mathematical load frequency model that I have. So this is on a good day. You've got no clouds, and you've got very smooth solar irradiance. And then this is the very next day. You've got very huge drops in energy from the grid. So we need to compensate that. So the amount of variability from solar and the wind, it's different sources of energy, but I assume that the amount of variability is the same. This is the effect on the grid frequency. As you increase the penetration of renewable energy, the increase in frequency variation also increases. And so the results that I have. For the old results, what I assume is that when the power drops from the wind or the PV, the battery kicks in to compensate for the drop in power. So what I found was that this instantaneous power input from the battery would cause oscillations and peaks and transients that are not desirable. So this is the input data for the simulation. So what I assume now was that I've got a PID controller that controls the amount of output from the battery, and that will regulate the frequency on the grid. As you can see, the blue is without storage, and the red is with storage. That's the frequency on the grid. And this is for wind. The results are obvious that you can see that energy storage can reduce the fluctuations of grid on the grid frequency. One of the main observations that I had was that you would assume that you switch in your battery as quick as possible when the wind or the PV drops would be the ideal situation, but I found out from my simulations that if you switch in as quickly as possible, you would create transients between different types of systems coming in at the same time. So I allowed a time delay in the battery coming in, and that allows for a better system. So my second observation was that if you've got conflicting time constants in the system, you would create a huge diverging frequency in the system, so it leads to instabilities. This is my third observation. You've got different droops in the system, and you would have different types of grid frequency response. And so that's it. Thank you.
Well done. Well done. That actually went a little quicker than I thought, so we have a nice break of about 25 minutes. We'll see everybody back here at 10:25. Thank you.